listening to Confessing Animals with Jen Harris and Vanessa Arrico, rebel poets, real rebels, really talking poets, rebelling and listening.
Okay, don't interrupt me.
Hello, welcome to another episode of Confessing Animals. Today we are going on the redemption journey with poet Jen Harris. Poet Jen Harris, she, they, is a creative entrepreneur based in Kansas City, Missouri. A sought-after performance artist, Harris is the co-host of Confessing Animals podcast, interviewing seasoned and fresh-faced artists of every genre to discuss how to make creativity work within the complexities and challenges of adult life. She is the founder and host of the Writing Workshop KC, whose mission is to nurture creative curiosity and inspire confidence within prompt-based writing workshops. Find her online at poetjenharris.com and at poetjenharris on Instagram. And again, we'll put all the links in the show notes. Jen is our wise and fearless leader, and I'm so excited for you guys to hear all about her redemption journey. Thank you for letting me know.
I know when they made that update on Zoom where it started telling you that you were being recorded, I was kind of relieved because I always thought it was super creepy that I wasn't sure if I was being recorded, but like also they had that red light for a while. Anyway, right. It's just nice to have the announcement made so I don't feel like, I don't know who I think is spying on me, but nonetheless, it feels like it should be something that's like really you're informed of, you know?
Everybody's spying on everybody at all times.
I think that that's actually what the American public believes, that they're so goddamn important that somehow their opinions have become facts and the government wants to get in their business. And it's like, well,
the microchipped people, like that, the anti-vaxxers that don't want to get vaccinated because they think they're microchipped. I'm like, you're already carrying around your phone. Like, you've microchipped yourself. Like, the government.
Bitch, you have a social security number.
Right.
Like you already have a serial number. Are you fucking stupid?
Right, like, this is implemented at birth, and, like, Ash and I were having the conversation earlier this week, and he's like, you know, the government no longer has to even do anything to us. It's like, we do it to ourselves at this point, like, how I was kind of saying about capitalism, now that we're all entrepreneurs in the gig economy, it's like, we're our own bosses subjugating ourselves now. It's like, when they figure out how to, like, make you just kill yourself, then, like, they don't have to do it for you anymore.
That's why I believe in a 12-hour work week. Why am I not getting any of my goals accomplished? No. You know,
I have no
accomplished goals, though. Hold on. Okay. Guess what showed up in the mail today? A Mother's Hunger.
I got mine, too.
Poems by Amanda Roth. So if you guys have not heard of Amanda Roth, I don't know what fucking rock you're living under, but you should know her. And this book, A Mother's Hunger, is available on the internet. Just Google it. I ordered mine off of Blurb. Oh my God. What a book. What a book.
Yeah. She read one of the poems that's in the book on the podcast when we had her on season two. And she talks about crawling in like the dryer or the washing machine or something. And it's like kind of like this portal. And it's like, all I can think about is like when I'm reading this book, like I want to crawl in after her. And I'm just like in there with her.
Well, what's so wild about that particular line is that I have a visual of it from, oops, spoiler alert, at Meow Wolf in Santa Fe, there's a dryer that you can open and you crawl through it and it takes you kind of like in a little tunnel slide. And it's, so it's plexiglass, blue LED with all of these clothes smashed against it. So you literally feel like you're in a dryer slide. Like, what the fuck? The first time I did that,
that's so
it
cool.
Blew my mind. And I like took girlfriend the second time I went, and she just stood there in total shock. Like, this is such a simple piece of art, but like I never thought to make it, but my imagination has played this out so many times. I remember as a kid wanting to like walk through the fridge or find Narnia at the back of my closet. And why aren't we designing architecture like this?
Yeah, Narnia has ruined all of us. We all want to climb through the wardrobe. And then that, the one with the cupboard, it was like the Indian in the cupboard. It's like, and then the magic school bus, like we were all like very little, like going inside of things, like in the 90s.
Honey, I Shrunk the Kids, man.
Yeah, exactly. Like, why isn't that all happening?
I don't know. I feel like that's what we should be putting our time and energy toward. Universal income for all so that I can work on my shrink ray. but also by A Mother's Hunger by Amanda Roth. These poems are exquisite. I have every faith in her, and I'm really excited to read this book. I had to wait. I don't know what the hell the delay was, but maybe it's like the Topo Chico shortage where just like they're out of raw materials and we're all fucked.
Right. There's someone who's like making handmade pages and glue in the back of the shed.
Listen, that's me 15 years ago. Yeah, that's how I started making chapbooks. Don't make me go back.
I am so excited to have this conversation, and I was kind of taking note. So when I tackled revenge, that was very like heady and philosophical. And I feel like now with the redemption, we are moving into like this mystical, spiritual kind
abstract.
Of
abstract.
Yeah, it's way more abstract, but like they're inextricably mm-hmm. linked. Revenge and redemption, because, you know, I started revenge off with a quote from Nietzsche, and within the same Thus Spoke Zarathustra story, like, it's also about redemption. And for Nietzsche, redemption was not, like, deliverance from sin, but it's, like, a total affirmation of life with all its pain and suffering and absurdity, right? So it's, like, we can't transform the past, but, like, with our current knowledge, we can kind of change how the past is understood and recalled. And so I really like that idea of how like, the past is constantly changing, because like once we have more information about ourselves or history or the world, it's not a revisionist history. It's not like we're changing anything. We just have a different understanding and a different perspective. But also he has this fake it till you make it kind of attitude. Like, you know, he says, to redeem the past and to transform every it was into an I wanted it thus, as if you had willed it to be, as if it could be no other way, right? It's almost like kind of taking charge of what was.
I am, let's just start with, I'm glad you found a way to fucking bring Nietzsche into this first thing. Of course you did. Also, okay, so in my doing my homework 10 minutes before class starts attitude was like, oh, I know all about redemption. And then I was like, oh my God, what the fuck is redemption? Right? Like that is my starting point for this conversation, because I'm asking myself, like, is redemption something you give to yourself? Is redemption something you achieve? Is it a return, but like a return to what? Have we fallen from grace? Are we pulled from it into a whirlpool of suffering?
Right.
And then somehow, wow, we break free. Is it what we become in spite of? Like, oh my God, I thought I knew what redemption was. And now I'm like, what the fuck is it?
It's interesting because very obviously when we say revenge, we think of an action, right? Like, it's like we're taking revenge. But when I hear redemption, I don't necessarily think of that as like an action verb, but all of the definitions start with the action of, like, redemption, the original like origin, Latin, is like the action of buying one's freedom. And then it's like the action of saving or being saved from sin. Or the action of regaining or gaining possession of something and clearing a debt, or like somehow something's been lost, right? So it's like this, there's very much action in this redemption that like I've never really thought about before.
Well, they talk about like the act of forgiveness, right? So as if forgiveness is something to give, to deliver. And then there's people who are like, well, yeah, but you need to give and deliver it to yourself. I don't know. Redemption feels murky in the same way that forgiveness feels murky, because it's just like, is redemption a series of events, like, is the whole experience redemptive? You know, because, like, the concept of redemption seems to revolve around, like, a great suffering on one end of the spectrum, abuse, poverty, and then you become a full, wholehearted person, like, a defiance of your environment and being, I don't know, you're not able to be separated from your nature, right? Mm-hmm. So you're able to defy your nurture for your nature. We're talking about redemption seems to be tangible and then abstract, like mm-hmm. on opposite ends of the spectrum. And I can't quite figure out how I define redemption, you know, like yeah. we're going into the season asking people like talk about revenge, talk about redemption. And I want them to talk about it from such a personal perspective, which I felt like was a challenge. But then I get in there to do my own research, having this kind of arrogant belief that I'm really sure of what redemption is. And I'm like, oh, I think redemption can only be talked about personally because its scope is pretty fucking enormous.
Right. Yeah. I mean, as soon as I started to dig in on redemption, any kind of research, I'm just like, oh God, here we go. Of course, it opens up the rabbit hole. It opens up this whole universe of things that, like, I didn't necessarily correlate with redemption. And it's hard too, because redemption, you have been redeemed. Like, it's this very, like, biblical, like, Christian, like,
right.
idea that, like, I don't have a personal connection to, right? So it's kind of like, do I, like, I've never really thought about redemption, like, as a personal thing.
Right. Well, and that's what I, girlfriend has a history in theology. And I think everybody knows to some degree, having been raised in the Midwest, I have a Christian background. And so I asked her what redemption was. And she said, you know, this something that seems lost forever is somehow found. And so I think that as a narrative, it's so easy to plug in, like, human beings were lost and they were brought to God through Jesus. So does that make Jesus a bridge? Like, is redemption a bridge between your origin of suffering and your ending of success, of triumph? Like, right. is when redemption the bridge?
Yeah. And if I think of Jesus as, like, this abstract concept, like a bridge, bringing light to something, right? Like, 'cause I think in the notes, like, we kind of mentioned this, like, dark night of the soul, right?
Well, a bridge is uniting, and it also, like, it's both tangible and abstract, because a bridge is a fair way through, right? But it's also carrying you from one place to the other. That is right. The nature of the bridge.
Right. And usually, like, on the other side of the bridge, we hope, like, is going to be some kind of, like, something better or a positivity or a resolution. And there's light at the end of the tunnel, right, so to say. And it's interesting because, like, this whole concept of the dark night of the soul, like, I kind of was introduced through a poet, William Blake. He has this poem about, like, you know, some are born to great delight, some are born to endless night. And the dark night of the soul comes from the priests and mystic Saint John of the Cross, right? And I guess I didn't really know what any of that meant. Like, in culturally
remix Confessing Animals.
Popularly is not a word. What am I trying to say?
What are you trying to say? Give me the whole sentence and I'll tell you how to say it correctly.
It's become kind of known. What is the word I'm looking for? Obviously, we're going to edit this all up, but I want to wait for
I'm
the word.
I'm keeping this whole fucking conversation in. Are you saying popular belief?
Yeah, I'm saying popular belief, but...
Okay. Majority belief?
A common understanding.
I'm not editing this out at all.
We think of, like, Dark Night of the Soul as just, like, some kind of, like, shit we're going through in life, right? Like, this hard time. I think of the Saturn return. You know, we kind of talked about that before on Amber's episode. You know, in your late 20s, you go through this whole Saturn return where, like, when you were born in your birth chart, where Saturn was in the sky has returned to where you are now. And it's usually like in your late 20s, like 27 to 30. And it's kind of a like a wake up call, right? And it's kind of like a chance to kind of be reborn, right? So I think of a lot of these things, like when I think of the redemption, because in St. John of the Cross, the dark night is described as a purgation, a purification of the soul, right? So it's very much like you are purifying your soul of senses, which makes me think of like ego death, and purification of spirit, which I never thought of soul and spirit as separate until now. And I realized, I guess they're separate things. And then it's kind of like this mystical journey for like, for the union of the divine, right? Which like, I can get into the mystical shit. I can think of like this purification and mystical union of the divine. That language speaks to me more than some kind of like sin and God.
Girl, you just said a fucking mouthful. You know what? I didn't think about the soul and spirit being different, but if I do, I immediately think that the soul is like a wool jacket and the spirit is the inner like silk lining. Mm. Like my spirit is so jovial and alive. My spirit is where my creativity lives and thrives. Yeah. But like my soul is like what keeps me grounded into my body.
Right. And then the spirit was described as your direct communication. That's the bridge. That's the direct bridge to God or to the divine, right? So it's like your soul is more like still, I think, attached to you personally, whereas the spirit is the communion, maybe.
It's like your introvert, extrovert of your...
Yeah, yeah. It's your sun sign and your moon sign.
Well, I think what I love the idea of a purification, of redemption involving an act of purification, because when I think about this as a purification process, I think it's unfortunate and very confusing, like a little conflicting to me, to think about, you know, if people suffer greatly at the hands by the actions of others, and then they have to travel that journey to come to a place where there's a fork in the road, where they choose seemingly to be either good or evil, right? Like you either choose to become the truest form of yourself or you choose to perpetuate violence. And I think it's interesting that like I'm thinking about how the violent road might be more well lit, might be more familiar, and the purification, the good choice, I guess, is one that is very dark because it's going to strip you now of all of the weight and that you carried with you and birth you new. I don't know. Is redemption seems to be a journey in and of itself. Like it's not just one action, I think.
Right.
I don't know. What do you think?
I love the idea of redemption as the journey. I guess as with everything else, you know what I mean? This whole life is this journey, right?
But do people choose to have a redemptive journey, or is a redemptive journey just a guarantee? Like, that's the part that I'm just like, well, I don't think everybody experiences redemption.
No. And I think it's the same thing about like finding meaning in your life. Like it's the meaning's not given to you. You have to like attribute meaning to your life. Right. So it's like, if you want a redemptive story, I think that you actively seek that out, because I think a lot of people don't want a redemptive story. They want to be
they want to be the redeemer.
Well, right? Some people do want to be the redeemer. I mean, some people want to be God. Some people want to be, you know what I mean? Some people want to be the villains. You know what I mean? Some people are so in their victimized mentality and isolated. And I think of a lot of people maybe that are having trouble accepting the reality of this COVID. I don't know what it is, but it's like, I think the journey is not an automatic thing. I think of the tarot cards a lot, because when you go through the tarot, that is the journey. You start with the Fool, you move to the Magician, you have all these tools. Like these are the people you meet along the way in your journey, right? And for me, tarot is a lot of, you know, it's a lot of self-reflection. It's a lot about attributing meaning, finding meaning, a way to like dig in your psyche, kind of psychoanalytic. You know, it's not, nothing's divination for me. Like I'm not into like divining the future or anything like that. But I think the same way redemption keeps calling back the past, right? It's a way to like, I've been redeemed from something that has happened in my past, right? But then like, what's redemption's role in the future? If we're constantly being redeemed from something that already happened, then you don't, like with enlightenment, you don't just like arrive at enlightenment and stay there. Like you constantly have to like be reminded, and you're constantly actively seeking that enlightenment. So the same thing with redemption. It's like, I don't think you just get redeemed. I think it's more of like an active practice. Per usual, we have gotten ahead of ourselves. So today, this is Vanessa Errico. You are listening to Confessing Animals, and my guest is poet Jen Harris. Today,
oh my God, hi.
Oh, hi. Thank you. So Jen's tackling redemption for us today. Obviously, we've been musing on that. But I kind of want to dig into her as the guest and her personal journey of redemption. So, Jen, start us off with a poem, and then we'll go from there.
Sorry, clearing my throat for the stage. Okay, so we have gotten ahead of ourselves per fucking usual. I thought a lot about what, I don't know, what redemption means, what redemption is, the relevance of it in my work. And I know that we've already started touching on this conversation of, you know, how it doesn't include divination for you, but it definitely has my experience in being raised in a Christian church. All of my childhood, all of my youth, a lot of religious language really shows up in my work. I do a lot of writing surrounding these kind of biblical notions that, I don't know, they're this compass of morality, this expectation of the way you conduct yourself as a human being. I can't escape those things just because I don't believe in like the group of people that introduced me to this philosophy, to this religion. Like, I don't know. I don't navigate it from that perspective anymore, but it can't help but have an influence, right? And then I was thinking about redemption as redemption as taking charge, redemption as being in possession of one's own experience. And then I decided I was going to read this poem about Gertrude and Alice, because I think that I know that in my writing of this poem, what I'm saying in its entirety is like they were just themselves. And if you're not familiar with Gertrude Stein and Alice B. Tolkis, get your shit together. Gertrude Stein wrote so avant-garde and so stream of consciousness, and I don't resonate with her art hardly at all, but I resonate with her being like a butch lesbian. I resonate with her stiff collars and her loving wife and how they, you know, they welcomed artists into their salon and they led this creative, beautiful, you know, not without its struggles life, but they were themselves. So this is my poem, Gertrude and Alice. Gertrude and Alice lived at the base of a war. For 30 years, they managed fine art and futzing about with no delusions of grandeur. They just were two women loving the freedom of their Parisian living by loving one another in broad daylight. No man painted Gertrude beautiful in oil or essay, but Alice must have seen something extraordinary to keep getting up every morning, straightening the manuscripts and misting the geraniums. She kept Gertrude in stiff collars, pressed pleats. I can almost smell the linseed and whiskey of a late night Hemingway, love drunk on possibility. Unbothered by their mortality, they raged within the confines of nothing. The world was theirs, and they knew it.
Oh, Jen, thank you so much for bringing us into that world, a world that I know so well. and that I love so much. And I love Gertrude Salon. I had this big phase where I was only reading, you know, like Paris in the 20s and all the Salons and Juna Barnes and everyone she had there. And I really like to think of this podcast as kind of like a modern day Salon, because like we all can't like get together and, you know, be in the Parisian Salon, but we are having these conversations and we are sharing our art and we are like feeding off in to one another. And, you know, I love that idea. So thank you. This poem is so beautiful. I've read it before and it's definitely one of my favorites. It's so like sensual. You're so in this poem. Like I feel comfortable. Like we are Gertrude, like sitting in that chair of hers. Right. And everyone's bringing their offering, right, for her to bless it.
Well, and she's such a redeeming figure, right? Because the thing about her not ever really being portrayed in any sort of beautiful light, like she was disagreeable, she was rotund, she was entirely enveloping, but not necessarily inviting. Right. And so you had to approach her and you had to be willing to participate in an experience with Gertrude that was navigated, created by her. She was not seemingly the kind of person that could be steered or controlled in that way.
Yeah.
But I think that's also what drove all of these great creators to her living room, was that she was going to provide an authentic experience in being who she was. And they craved that as creatives and as people. I feel like I'm surrounded in people who can't help but be themselves.
Right.
And I love that about, I mean, that's how I see myself in the reflection of her and of her own experience with lesbianism. Like, she didn't stand for it. She didn't stand against it. She just existed. And that was enough.
You know, there's,
yeah, there's no, like, record I can find of her being particularly an activist.
Right.
And, you know, while I've done a lot of activism work for my queer community, like, I never wanted to be known as solely as a lesbian author, because I didn't want to be put in the LGBTQ section of a bookstore that's so small, so narrow, so specific. I wanted to be able to reach out with my writing and reach across the table to
complete
strangers.
Yeah, you
want to
be on the shelf where the broad audience is going to come upon you. And it's like, yeah, I love that about her too. And I just love the idea of all these like young men writers like bringing their work to her. And if like Gertrude's like, no, this sucks. Like them like, you know, running with their tails between their legs to like go try to fix it. But I love the healthy competition that I think that setting provided. These artists, I mean, because there's painters, there's writers, there's dancers, there's a lot of people that were associated like with this era. And I love that so much, because it's like I'm so visually stimulated. Like I draw a lot of inspiration from different types of mediums and different types of art, but I love that idea of healthy competition. Like, I like having these conversations, philosophical and poetic and mystical and spiritual and everything, because it's like, and I kind of feel like we get a lot of that in WWKC, because, like, you know, we get to hear these great voices each week. You know what I mean? And they are uplifting and they are inspiring. And I think, you know, again, like, we're all being fed by this community.
Well, truly, and it's not intentionally competitive, but I do feel challenged, right? Like there are people that are doing what I love to do better than me. And that better than me is entirely a personal judgment. When I'm hearing someone do something that truly strikes me, and I also feel kind of a twinge of jealousy, I love jealousy, because jealousy illuminates what I want. And so I have no time to bullshit with jealousy. I don't fuck around with like, why do I feel it? I don't grovel with jealousy. I interact with it, because I'm like, what the fuck is it that they just did, said, made me feel that I want to be able to emulate in this world? I want to be able to produce authentically. Mm-hmm. But yeah, this, I think people coming into Gertrude and Alice's Salon, you know, which at this point is just their living room. It's not some sort of special room we don't have, you know, but it's coming into that salon and being, and knowing that you would be seen. And I think it's so interesting to think about, like, Zelda Fitzgerald was there just as much as F. Scott. And so you know, Zelda at the height of her alcoholism, perhaps the beginning. I don't know the full timeline of Zelda's life, but I do know that in every regard, she's portrayed as a crazy alcoholic. And I wonder if she ever stood in Gertrude's salon and saw, you know, looked at Gertrude and Alice's freedom with any sort of envy, mm-hmm. or if she was compelled to keep creating quietly behind the scenes in the shadow of her husband because she saw Gertrude and Alice. You know, I also deeply wonder about Alice's creativity.
Right.
Were they so ingrained in a sort of gender rolled relationship that Alice never created anything, or was Alice's creation in, was it in the way that she kept a home and the way that she supported, you know what I mean? Like, editors aren't writers, not in the instance of, like, if you hand me your manuscript, I did right. not write your manuscript. But everybody's got this really important role that creates the fullness of creativity. And I, when I look at them, I'm so clearly able to see the balance and what they brought.
Yeah. You know? I like, in the poem, you actually mention the word freedom. You know, they were just two women, you know, loving the freedom of their Parisian living, right? And you mentioned something about possession and in possession of. And when I go back to the definition of redemption, it's like the action of buying one's freedom, right? It's like living in that comfort of their freedom, like without an agenda, they solely just kind of like owned the self and their position, right? Like, I like the connection of that, like, their freedom and being in possession of it.
Truly. Well, the Webster's Dictionary defines in the definition of redemption that you offered about, you know, buying one's freedom, the origin of that Latin phrase. I think that we all have to purchase our freedom. That whole idea, the whole idea of the United States of, like, freedom is inherent. I don't believe that to be true on a spiritual level, because I think that in order for a woman, let's say, let's just go back to Gertrude and Alice, in order for those two women to have been together, not necessarily out and open, but not closeted, certainly, because their friends and colleagues knew that they were together emotionally, romantically, they had to lose something. They had to pay a price in some way for the freedom to live that way. Like, I know that Gertrude had an inheritance and she got a monthly check from her brother, right? So, like, that kind of patronage certainly supported some base level of existence. But, like, they didn't have any, you know, they didn't have any property or any sort of, like, titles. They didn't have any position in society based on their husbands. And while that was kind of fading out in the 30s, it's not any more or less relevant than it is now. Like, you know, you are a celebrity based on your name in some parts of this country, as opposed to just the everyday schmoes that are just, you know, buying their own shit and living their own life.
Yeah, so, I mean, you're born with a name or you buy your way in. I mean, it's money or a name that's already established, right?
Right. And so I think about them being free in that they had to pay some sort of price to be there. So if that price was the comfort of what was to be societally expected, you know, these women would not be working out in the world. They would be working at home with their raising their children and being financially supported in this other way. And that, I think that's a price to pay, to risk having to support yourself in a world that's unlikely to hire you in order to be in love. Because I don't think Gertrude or Alice could have run out and gotten a fucking job at Starbucks. You know what I mean? Like, you get like three or four positions. And then I know from personal experience that Gertrude would have likely faced, you know, relative discrimination for appearing the way that she did. You know, just like there's all these things at play that I believe are at play now that were in play then, that would have made being open and out hard. And I wonder too if any element of that is what drove them to Paris, if the sexual freedom and frivolity of Paris is why they were there in the first place.
Absolutely. So many artists, you know, fled to Paris to have more of that freedom. And in a very real sense, I think of James Baldwin, I think of Nina Simone, I think of the great black artist from America who we all know America has never been free except for, you know, white land and slave owning men. Buying one's freedom looks very different for black people than it does for us. But a lot of them did go to Paris and they wrote about being able to exist and create and like feel a sense of freedom that they could never feel here because of the racial tension is so strong today as it ever was, as it was then, as always, right? So it's like there's so many levels of this possession, of buying one's freedom, of artistic creativity, and where you can even be to like have the chance to redeem yourself from this made up sin.
Right. These notions of who you are declared upon you or enacted upon you. I know the violence, and I don't think there's any comparison in that. I know throughout the, in my own queer theory, research, reading, college, blah, 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 I know that the experience queer people have had in this country are like some generations are more accepting than others. And we are in a generation that is likely to be the most accepting of all, but we weren't always this hostile either. This hostility comes from 50s Christianity and the rise of the televangelists. But we do know that the racial tension and racism of America has remained the same the whole time. So I don't think there's any comparison, but I do think that redemption looks drastically different based upon your cultural experience. So
absolutely.
What and you're being redeemed from is important, is relevant to the story too.
God, like we all need to be redeemed from like other people's fucking point of view of us, right? Like that's what we need to be redeemed from. But like, and it makes me think of like the cyclical notion too. Like I talked a lot about the repetition and the cycles and revenge. And I think of the cycles that each generation goes through with like being more visible or being more accepted. And like maybe, you know, the hostility has returned, like the Reagan era has returned, however you want to look at it from politics or from like a cultural social standpoint. It's like maybe because queer people have like more visibility, then like there's more hostility, right? Like, but now I feel like, yes, things are cyclical, and I found this, I watched this amazing documentary about, like, these women artists, and it's like, Heresies is what they called themselves. They were, like, a group of, like, women artists, like, in New York, and they created, like, this magazine, which can all be downloaded for free, which are very cool, and I downloaded the one they did on violence, because it's part of a project I'm working on right now, but it's like, I'm reading this, was all published in the late 70s, I could read this exact same thing printed now. Like nothing that these women are talking about in regards to art or visibility or women or violence or any of this cultural nonsense. It's like nothing's changed. Not you blink and you're just still there.
Girl, my sister was sending me, she sent me a song that we used to listen to, you know, like 20 years ago that just like happened to come up on a playlist or whatever. Do you know the band Styx, STYX? Hair band from the 80s,
yeah.
Right?
Yeah, yeah.
There's a song they have called Too Much Time on My Hands, which has a double clap in it, which is part of why I love it. But I listened, my sister sent it to me and she was like, oh, it's like the good old days, but we don't smoke anymore, you know? And I listened to it for nostalgia's sake and same shit. If I read these lyrics to you, it's like elitism, classism, racism, sexism, poverty, the diminishment of artists in the community and as a collective, as an individual, like it's really gross that everything remains present day relevant to like a T.
Everything.
Yeah. It disgusts me, which I mean, I think is why I'm trying to, why we're having these conversations on the podcast in the first place. Just like, I want other people to feel validated in their rage, in their confusion, in their frustration. Like, I want to talk about these subjects on big and small scales because I think we're all feeling the nuance of our human experience in this way. But I, you know, where else can you go to talk about a bunch of random shit but here on Confessing Animals?
Yeah, no shit. Like,
it all ties exactly together.
We got to talk it out. We got to talk it out. You know what I mean? Like, I feel like it's just, like, part of the purge. Like, here we go. It's like...
Absolutely. Those hand motions are my favorite.
Well, it's like it's part of, like, shaking out that anxious negative energy, right? It's like, I want to, like, I talk it out, and then I want to, like, wipe it off of me. Like, whew.
Oh, so true. What were we talking about?
Who knows? But like, getting back to you, like, let's back up, and I want to know what you were like as a child.
Mouthy.
Oh, I see. Much has changed.
Right. You know, when I look at the parts of my childhood that are making me really happy that I want to recall intentionally, I was a really imaginative, creative, curious kid. You know, I was always, I think now knowing that I am, I have a lot of sensory related issues. You know, like things are too loud, things I can't handle certain textures. Like I'm realizing that my world was very much shaped by my sensory experience. And so I don't know if it was great that it was never really like acknowledged on a medical scale because I've had to do a lot of work to learn how to make myself feel safe and comfortable in the world now with these certain sensory things I'm aware of. Like
right.
The world is really loud to me all the time. And I was going to buy headphones to like help kind of close it in. But I also then like have to deal with the stigma of people being like, why is that person wearing headphones around? Which is why I ended up buying these big ass headphones.
I relate to this so much. These noise canceling yeah. headphones that I have on that like my work got for us. Like once I put them on, even if I'm not listening to anything, I keep them on my head. And mm-hmm. I think like I have a sensory problem too, because it's like I literally just want to buy a helmet and wear these
yeah.
noise canceling earphones all the time. It's like I feel contained in a way that it's like, okay, it's like I've almost like shielded myself from a little bit of overload.
Yeah, it's like this is an anchor. Like if I have yeah. this on, it's kind of like a hat that keeps me involved with gravity.
Right.
And it's, so I think as a kid, I had a lot of like really intense reactions to my environments, through this filter. Like I always noticed the texture of the grass. I remember the colors of things and the smells of things and the sounds of things really, really, without intention. Like just everything, when I close my eyes and I try to have like a memory of a place, like someone will be like, when was the first time we met? And I can remember like the color of the hallway, mm-hmm. you know, there. And I think that's part of what makes me a poet, because right. when I compare my writing style to people who write prose, I have the smell, I have the light, I have the texture of something that my hands or feet are on. But I don't have the specifics. I couldn't tell you what the wood grain direction was. I couldn't tell you where we were going or like, well, I have the feeling of it. Right. So I think that I was probably a big pain in the ass to raise, because everything, I'm very particular about everything and I'm very vocal. But I don't know. I just kind of did whatever I wanted, I think, through high school. I think I still do it now, but they would be like, get in line. And I'm like, I don't know if I feel like getting in line. And, you know, they'd be, I don't know. I wanted to do what I wanted to do. And I didn't feel compelled to prioritize any direction over my own inclinations.
Yeah.
At the same time being like a deep, like a codependent in training, not quite a people pleaser, but just like, I don't know, codependency still really got its fucking claws in me. So
yeah,
I think that I was spirited.
Speaking of the spirit. So I know you grew up like with a lot of that Christian dogma and like, you know, that obviously had to shape your like early ways of thinking, or like it shaped the way you were being treated around you or certain beliefs were held, right?
Yes.
I know that, you know, I don't know, like how did you have a come to Jesus moment, you know, forgive the pun, like outside of kind of like the scope of like Jesus and Christianity, where you were like, okay, I kind of need to like separate myself from how I've been raised to like who I know that I need to become? Like, how is that like redemptive path? Like, what does that look like for you? And to me, it seems like it's come through like finding your voice through the poetry. A lot of your poetry to me, truly has this, message that you're conveying. It's like, I am me and I am free, right? Like, and how did you get to that point?
That's a great series of questions. Thank you. So I think that you and I've talked about this, I know, in person or, you know, in our online relationship, maybe on the podcast, but like the reason that neither one of us are, dead from drug use, besides like a lot of close calls and good luck, is that we both always had a voice in us that told us when to stop, mm-hmm. like when to leave, when to like, we had to like a knock it off and get going voice. I don't know why we both possess that, but I think that that's a voice I've always known and trusted in myself. So even when I put myself in dangerous, risky, truly terrifying experiences from time to time, when I've made conscious choices to put myself at risk in some way, I've always had this kind of sense of something is overseeing me. Mm-hmm. Like it's both retained and external. And so that it's a voice that tells me when to move, yes. like step out of the way. And I don't know what that is. I related it when I was young to the notion that like there was like a God or Jesus like on my shoulder, like hanging out, you know, the two sets of footsteps kind of thing.
Right.
One set of footsteps. I correlated that with the presence of God as a child. I think I still correlate it with the presence of God, but I feel much more, I feel very loose about its label, about the way it looks. Like it's more, you know, I could call it energy and say like, I feel like, you know, there's, something that lingers within me or around mm-hmm. me, for me, because of me, I don't know, that guides me in some way. I never really feel like I'm alone.
Yeah. And no, I totally relate to that. I almost kind of think of it. It's like, almost like this internal sense of like self-knowing or self-possession. It's almost like, okay, like I've always kind of sensed myself as like a visitor, or what everything I've done is looked at as like a phase. Like I wasn't a drug addict. I was a drug abuser. I was, right. you know what I mean? It's like, it's always been like, I'm dipping my toe in here and I'm going to excessively do this until I'm like, okay, like now, like that is, it's like that push. It's like something's physically always like, go. Like, mm-hmm. okay, it's time to go on to the next thing now.
Right. I'll let you wander this tangent for, I don't know, a while. And then we're going to come back out. You know, it's like, let's go. Your time at the playground is done. And I've always experienced that. So that voice is very much the voice that has guided me through my own redemptive journey, right? Like that voice was like, I didn't come out on purpose. Like I don't have my journals or anything from 20 years ago. So the details are getting foggier. Mm-hmm. What I know is that I inherently knew I could tell my friends sort of that I was gay, but I couldn't tell any of the adults in my life. And it was unsafe to tell them. And I just knew that. But what I also couldn't do ever was hide who I am. I can't mm-hmm. hide the thoughts in my fucking head. I can't hide my opinions about some shit.
Yeah, our mouths live on our sleeve. Like, there's really, no, you don't ever have to guess what we're thinking and feeling.
Right, and the part of me that speaks intentionally, empathetically, lovingly is a very, very real trained part of me, because I've worked really hard to be empathetic and not accusatory. I've worked really hard to be less of a drill sergeant and more of like a soft place. And so I'm just very aware that that in me there is a drive to be the most realized version of myself. I've always been compelled to honor the truth of who I am. And I don't know where that voice comes from. I don't know what fuels it. I used to believe it's God. Now I believe it's more of like my ethereal self, my connection to the universe, my place in the world. There's so many things contained in that voice now that it could be, or it could be all of them working, you know, in conjunction with one another. But I don't know. I just, when I was rejected by the church, which it's not like they had like a, you know, a pitchfork,
and you know, chased like, you down.
Yeah, they didn't, they just made it very clear that I was sinning. And I was like, oh, well, this ain't gonna work out.
Yeah.
And, you know, my parents were in a place where they had a different understanding of what everything meant. You know, they have grown so much in the last 20 years. They have become allies in every way. So I don't want to hold it over their head the way we started this fucking party, because they were reacting from a cultural place in every regard. They were religious. They were raised in the South. Like, my folks have come a long way. We've all grown.
Right. But and then there lies kind of like that redemptive notion of just like viewing the past through like a different lens, right? It's like I've kind of your parents have almost been redeemed in their growth and understanding,
right? I think redemption part of it that I you know, like you were talking about the tunnel and the light at the end of the tunnel. The light at the end of the tunnel suggests more space exists, right? Like the tunnel is so narrow and dark. But I mean, that's the journey of redemption, is like you break open further and further and further until you are no longer this tightened singular experience. You are part of the universe.
Yeah.
You know, and like that's, I've been running towards that light my entire life. Like, I mean, literally coast to coast, everywhere I can find it. I'm always searching for the perfect light and the perfect wind. And like the writer in me is taking all of this in, but it's also a spiritual calling to be. Right. To be immersed, to be one. You know, I love feeling small, in that like when I'm standing there at the edge of the ocean and I get to, I've loved making the declaration, like, I don't fucking matter.
Oh, the first time I heard like a radio lab about like Carl Sagan and how they like shot this thing up to space with like all these different languages and music. And like, and when I think about the cosmos and I think of how small we are, that's what brings me comfort. That's how I would never want to be the center of any kind of weird God shit. Like, it makes no sense. Like, I feel so good knowing how small I am, how every little galactic atom that our body is made up of, you know, like came from out there.
Well, and the part where like we are all, you know, that whole notion of like we're all one, I know it's overplayed and it's been commercialized and ugh, it's, we're all sick of like the whole unity notion. But the truth of unity is that I the smaller I feel, the more a part of everything I feel.
Well, because that's a part of like when the coexist becomes the bumper sticker, we're no longer actually seeking that unity and coexisting. It's just become a bumper sticker.
Well, yeah, it's kind of like, well, hold hands with your neighbors in a very Red Rover fashion and just like be nice.
Right.
You know, it's not, it's a join hands and pray. Like it doesn't call me to a passion to be like right. The most accepting. So I think that outside of the way I was raised is impossible for me to have a perspective on, because I don't remember a time in my life where church and Jesus were not there. But I know that walking that journey, it made me seek great empathy for other people. And even when that was expressed in ways that I'm now ashamed of, in that like really wanting all of my friends to be converted to Christianity so they would be like, the goal was that they would be there with me. They would be safe in this safe place with me. And I just don't feel compelled to go about it that way anymore. I feel like we're all in this together, and the less attached I can be to the idea that I singular am the center of the universe, the happier I am as a person.
Yeah. And I love the notion of
not having that agenda, not evangelicalizing everything, and being that presence, being in possession of self, being that comfortable person just sitting where you're at, like Gertrude. You have brought all these people to you. It's kind of like your center of in the workshop, right? Like, it's like you wholly sit in who yourself, and you're very open and honest. And it really gives us a space to all kind of like show up and do the same thing, to be open, to be honest, to be comfortable in ourselves, to share our truths, to be vulnerably aggressive, to have a brave space, not a safe space. Like all our mantras, you know, everything we say, it's like, I think it's really healing. I think that's really important, just like being around people who are just so comfortably themselves, and you getting that invitation to do the same thing.
Well, it's striking to me because I feel kind of like, specific to the writing workshop, Casey, and the people that attend, like, I feel like we're all in the same parking lot. You know, like, that's it. That's all life is. It's a parking lot. You pick your spot and then you leave.
Great. We're all in Lost in the parking lot waiting to go inside the fucking church.
Well, that's the thing. I mean, like, we're in each other's orbit. You know, we've traveled many, many miles to get here. None of us feel great about being ourselves at any particular given or consistent time. Like, we are I think the task of those who desire to evolve is knowing that you will exist in a place of great discomfort with regularity, because there is no comfort there are small comforts in the journey. That's why you're told not to take things for granted, or when you have a partner and that partner and you are in good places together, you know, you're compatible, you have that chemistry, like not taking that for granted is because the journey alone is lonelier. Mm-hmm. And the journey alone for me is when I'm alone, I have the awareness to open my eyes wider, like to look for people who are making and being beauty. And then I don't feel so alone. Like the only way to go through this is by yourself, but you don't have to do it alone.
Right.
And I want to continue to remind people that it's temporary, which is why you're supposed to savor it.
Mm-hmm.
You know, it's going to vanish. And
it's going to change. You know what I mean? Like, my goal has never been to be happy. Like, I didn't go to therapy saying, okay, I need to learn how to be happy. Like, to me, happiness, like, I can feel happy. I'm happy at times, but that's never been my goal. You know, it is the constant, you know, when I think of redemption, to be renewed, to continuously change and to understand and become like a better version of me. Like the more I know myself, the better person, the better version of me that I can be, which like benefits everybody. Like you said, you know, like we've done so much work on ourselves in therapy and through reading and all the work that we do to like not be so defensive or not have these kind of reactions or how not to be codependent or, you know, all the work that we do, you know, to be a better version of ourselves for us, but for other people too, though, we're around.
Well, I love that you said it's also to the benefit of other people, because that's what I'm saying, you know, like the more expansive you are, the more inclusive you can be, and that you have to be willing to break yourself open time and time again to keep receiving more and more light, more and more space. And I think that's the thing, you know, redemption is illumination.
It is the illumination. It's the William Blake. It's the it's the metamorphosis. It's the illumination. Yeah. It's all of that.
And I that's why I think it's interesting to be in possession of, because it's almost like I'm trying to be less in possession so that I can be more in redemption.
Thanks for listening to another episode of Confessing Animals. If you enjoyed this conversation and wanted to continue, join us over on Patreon for the full interview with Jen Harris, which includes an incredible video poem. patreon.com/confessinganimalspodcast.